Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Welcome to the Elbphilharmonie Talk. Today, in this episode, you will hear me in conversation with Laila Josefovic, one of the great contemporary violinists, a woman from the US who has decided a good 20 years ago to only play music from the 20th and the 21st century, more or less, with a few exceptions probably. And she came to Hamburg, to our hall, to finally give her debut concert in February this year, 2023, with John Adams's piece Scheherazade .2, a piece that he wrote for her and that she premiered 2015 with the New York Philharmonic under the baton of Alan Gilbert in New York. Now Alan Gilbert being in Hamburg as the chief conductor of the NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchestra for a while now, he always figured he wanted to bring this piece to Hamburg and to the Elbphilharmonie, and now it finally worked. We spoke directly after the dress rehearsal was over, and this is such a demanding piece, and she really fought as if the hall would be packed. It was just her and the orchestra, and she would really give it all. And she also gave all in our conversation. So I hope you will enjoy this. I don't know where to begin, to be honest. I just heard you rehearse the Scheherazade of John Adams with the NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchestra, and it is, for one, it's a stunning piece, and the other thing, of course, is your performance, which is really breathtaking and so highly energetic. And kudos to you to come at all after such a rehearsal to do an interview with me.
Oh, gosh, it's a pleasure, and it's an honor to have this experience here. I'm very grateful for that, and I'm very excited and in admiration of the orchestra for the incredible job that they're doing in this and the great, great demands that are put on everyone in this piece, not just me. The orchestra has an incredibly demanding and intricate and always the shifting tectonic plates of the score are always in motion.
One has to be very alert all the time.
It takes incredible concentration from everyone. And Alan is just fabulous. He's the man for this.
I mean, you have world premiered the piece almost 8 years ago in New York when he was still with the New York Phil. And he knows the piece, of course. But then, of course, he conducts so many other pieces
so
in between.
Many works.
And it kind of gets not into oblivion, probably, but still, you have to rework the thing in order to be...
Even I do so many other scores, but when I come back to this one, I'm sort of in awe of many aspects of the piece. First of all, the incredible strength of the ideas and the narrative and the story and what this is all about. So John wrote this in, 2013, 14, and then the premiere was in 2015, and the whole symphonic, huge kind of tone poem narrative aspect of the orchestra part. And he said to me, I want to do a piece that's not a violin concerto, that's a symphony with violin. And the epic scale of the story, so the girl, the woman, but the young, vulnerable and incredibly brave person who this woman is, and how she's put completely to the test. Her life is condemned. Her spirit is attempted to be crushed by the fanatics, the true believers in the score. And there's a real story in the score that he's written out very clearly, where in the beginning there's some very kind of lighter and playful dance-like moments, and she's got spirit and spunk. She's got some wit and some bite, and is put then into grave danger by the men who see her as a threat in a society that she is not welcome to take on.
Why is she not welcome? Is she powerful? This is a
modern take on Scheherazade. So,
I know, yeah.
So this, and it's happening right now with the Taliban. It's something that's happening now, right now. So a woman steps out of line, She's a threat and she should be condemned to death. And she should not be bothered with. She should not be holding this power or this insolence. Mm-hmm. So she's condemned to death and she has to escape. And in the middle of all of this, she shows her humanity, her expression, her deep longings, her desires. The second movement is called A Long Desire. She shows her heart, mm-hmm. and her longings and her desires and her the vulnerability is incredible. And this was one of the things that I have to express in my performance. And you know, this whole thing is that the violin solo part is a character role. And this was also something that he was aiming for, and it was sort of fun to talk about with him, because we acknowledged that there isn't really a piece in the violin repertoire that's quite this strongly taking on a character role.
Mm-hmm. You might think of Harold en Italie, you know, this
a little bit, yes. Or, you know, the Don Quixote kind of thing.
Yeah, the Richard Strauss symphonische Dichtung and kind of big scale things. But with this solo instrument so prominently exposed, it's still something a little...
So there are times, actually, in the piece where it becomes sort of an operatic thing.
Mm-hmm, totally.
And the violin is really speaking or singing. You know, singing, yes, we're used to a string instrument singing, sure. But this is something that's really a character talking in the most literal way, straight in a very raw sense to the audience and for the music. So it's something that should be epically exhausting for it to be a real performance.
Yeah, I think this is pretty promised.
The dangers, it's kind of interesting, because the frantic nature of when she becomes in danger in the music, there's moments of so much, when I had to revisit so much peril, when I had to revisit this piece, there was a bit of gap between, you know, all of us with COVID and everything. Mm-hmm. And then I had come back to it and I was like, wow, this piece has so much peril in it, mm-hmm. so much danger. There's not usually a piece that is about danger mm-hmm. in this way. And the
Which
kind of...
Which makes it particularly captivating also,
yes.
of course.
And the very big challenge in it, of course, is that in the middle of becoming this woman, I still have to have this almost sort of computer brain in which I'm just practically remembering...
Which bar I am in.
Which, who's doing what when... And there has to be sort of, at the same time, a certain kind of removal mm-hmm. so that it's not so raw, so emotional, that, you know, the accuracy of everything is not as it should be. So there's this kind of balancing act of being in complete control of the piece and the practicalities of the ensemble, the counting, the keeping track of cues, the entrances and the exits, just playing with certain people at certain times and having that also in your mind while, you know, she's completely losing it over something and expressing that.
So multiple brains would come in handy.
It's the ultimate multitask piece.
Yeah. Would you say it's the most challenging piece in some ways that you've ever played?
Emotionally, it's just uncompromising. And there's not really a piece that's quite on this scale, that it's a sense of near-death experience happening at this very moment. And there's not kind of a sense of nostalgia about it at all. It's sort of a fighting piece. She's a fighter. And that's very much in my character as well. John knows me very well. I've had many periods in my life that were not, obviously, thank goodness, not on the scale of Scheherazade's peril, but there were definitely times where I had to fight for what I wanted, and there were times I had to fight for just my own sense of self through the years, and mm-hmm. it comes out beautifully in this piece.
Yeah, I find it very apparent, and it's obvious that he had you in mind when he would compose, and I was asking myself, when When did you, I mean, you have been friends for forever, pretty much like in the early turn of the century, I think, when you started playing his violin concerto. But
yeah,
how often have you been talking with him during the process of the composition? And he would show you maybe parts and speak through with you.
He was funny with me because we probably played his first violin concerto over 150 times or something. Mm-hmm. And then we had the Dharma at Big Sur piece.
With the electric violin.
I don't play really so much anymore mm-hmm. because I'm a little bit gun shy of the electric issues. Just the amp and the...
Just technically, or...
a bit, yes. I mean, it's an amazing, gorgeous piece, though, but we did that many, many times. But he's like, you know, I'm writing this... You know, I'm writing your piece, and I'm really working on it, and you'll see what it's about. And he was sort of a little cryptic about it.
Oh, nice.
He kind of didn't want to give it all away to me, but... It's about Scheherazade. And I was sort of like, oh, wow. Really? Okay. Like, but it only became clear to me maybe after a year or so of him writing it quite the epic scale that this was taking on. And I think for him as well, he knew it was always going to be a big thing. But then he realized to me, he told me once that he worked on this almost as much as his operas.
Mm-hmm.
And it is sort of an opera.
I would say. Yeah.
So, but I'm very grateful to everyone here and to Alan for doing this, because all of my dreams with new music would definitely not be lifted off the ground without other people's help mm-hmm. and enthusiasm and involvement. So it's all nice for me to say, I love doing this, and this means a lot, and it's so important, and all this. But without those other people saying, yes, we need this piece. Alan says, I want to bring this piece here. And I'm like, oh, so wonderful, so great.
And it's interesting because we expected you to come in 2020 with the Tom Ades violin concerto, and then COVID hit and it didn't take place. And you have, as far as I remember, never performed in Hamburg. Is that true? Or am I just omitting something here?
I did something like maybe long time ago?
It must be very long.
Very long.
Because the archive wouldn't, you know.
Interesting.
Maybe older archives would, but I mean, you're not that old. I mean, come on.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering.
I think maybe I had come here on a tour in my teens even.
Oh, see.
I mean, but this is a long time.
Yeah. Rather in the child prodigy phase of your career. Before the catharsis kicked in. And
the long desire phase where I had to figure everything out for myself.
Yeah.
People had so many ideas about everything. What I should do, how I should play, what was the right piece for me, what pieces weren't the right pieces for me. And it was just like, everybody, stop. I have to figure out my sound, my choices, my life, my motives, and my dreams. And I kind of discovered a lot of them with John.
Mm-hmm.
So he's with me from the beginning of this path.
He's like the pivotal point.
Yeah,
in this,
absolutely.
In this. Yeah.
And after that, it was like an explosion. I mean, I realized how much this meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
I went to John, I mean, because it was more actually when I was 19, 20, it was sort of a bit of an experiment for me. At the time, I think he was a star, but not in the same way he is now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been just astounding to see how the world has really performed his music and taken him on in this way. And he's a very controversial figure. I mean, composers all have very strong ideas about John. And they're usually...
Some say he's too conservative. Others say what?
He's somebody that is a remarkable person. He's very 100% unabashedly himself, uncompromisingly himself. And there's not so many composers who I think have had all kinds of training, and he could write in any style he wants.
Mm-hmm.
But then he really did just show himself as he is. He doesn't feel he has to write in a certain style unless he really just genuinely feels this calling. And I think that's the dream of any composer, to find the strength of their sound on that level.
And it is almost ridiculous if you read Wikipedia about John Adamson. And, you know, he's ranked, you know, together with Terry Riley and Steve Reich as like the minimalists, which is like so utterly, and it's not totally wrong, but it's so far away from what he all does and what his work encompasses, especially this concerto. I mean,
if people call him a minimalist, they don't at all really understand him or his music. And they shouldn't be allowed to call him anything, really. No one should be able to call him or put him in any sort of some kind
pigeonhole
of convenient slot.
Yeah.
It's so not what he really is about. There's a complexity inside everything that he writes that is far from minimalist. Now, of course, he came from this. And this has been the amazing thing to see, his transformation kind of out of it in a certain way, that he obviously was influenced in his earlier years by that. But then you listen to the Chamber Symphony and he was influenced by Schoenberg. So should we say he's part of the second Viennese school?
<It's the same laughs>
you know, seriously, like for someone, the era of the time, you know, obviously
when
he was coming out
like
of the minimalist language in a certain way. But is he a minimalist composer? No, he is not.
No. Lila, I wonder, when did you last played or performed Beethoven or Mendelssohn or any of these concertos?
Yeah, it's a good question. Probably not since I was about 20.
Really? So strong was that
it was
term
so strong.
To really say,
it was
I don't play
so
this anymore.
So strong. And it's so weird for me. I mean, the whole recording boom was happening as I was a prodigy. And the crazy times of the, it almost reminds me, it sounds really bad to say, but it almost reminds me of sort of like the hedge fund world, where you had this like these epic, lavish, expensive
budgets
coming from these CD companies, of the promotional things and the parties and the you know, the interviews and the promote. Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to see how the world has changed since then. And I was sort of writing on the tail end of that era. So I got all these recordings made, you know, of kind of more standard works when I was a kid. And I'm lucky to have been able to make those then. But, you know, the whole thing is, well, you know, we want to record this because it's popular, but we have, you know, 20 other recordings of the same repertoire. So this is a problem. But then we don't want to record something that's less known because it won't sell. So what are we going to do?
We're going to do Mendelssohn and Beethoven.
We're going to do more standard works, which, you know, of course, this was my training. And I remember being in my late teens and thinking, this is amazing and great, but it's not something that hits my core strong enough for me to do this only for decades more. Like, I knew it. It was more a question of, okay, so then what am I actually really going to do? And at this point, this was, you know, mid-90s. There weren't, I think, the same open minds around contemporary music at that time that there are now.
And probably also the contemporary music was still a little more, you know, into the serial strictness, and it was not
It was
that
sort of rarefied, I think, it was put, I mean, even way more than it is now into a special kind of category where, you know, you had all these nerdy fans who would, but it wasn't enough to be mainstream in any way. And when I actually realized that there is a world out there, there is like a huge universe of minds who are producing completely new sounds. And I want to know them. I want to know these people. I want to play them. I want to perform all of this. And I was so hungry to get into a new chapter of my life where I could be expressive in all of these ways that I wasn't kind of, I wouldn't say not allowed to be, but just that I hadn't had the chance to be able to do. So it was like an explosion when I finally could. And I could take sort of some of the training and the skills from, because everything kind of leads to another thing, the training of the of my teens and the standard works and the diligent care that everyone gives to the standard works. Why do the new pieces not deserve the same? And it will transform the performance of the piece.
Absolutely.
And the power, especially, that the performer has in a piece that people don't know is so huge and important. Because, you know, with any piece, the performer has huge responsibilities and potential capabilities for expression. But most people, because if you play a standard work, they know,
oh,
this place, I love this place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a comparative listening aspect. But with something like a piece like People Will Hear Tomorrow, there isn't this sort of catalog, backlog of, you know, things that you could study up on. It was funny when I had to, like, when I had to relearn in a certain way, come back to this piece, I wouldn't have wanted to listen to myself because often I hate listening to my own recordings, but I had to because there wasn't another one, and that's it. So it came, of course, right back to me. This is, you know, after the pandemic, because this is another form of celebration, I think. I mean, look how many people are on the stage.
Mm-hmm. And how close they sit to one
another. It's
a
celebration.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're back.
We're still very aware of this. Yeah.
We're still getting COVID, but we're back.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to take this lying down. We're fighting, and we're back on stage.
Yeah.
So we're playing. We're going to play for you. And that, to me, is somehow moving in a way that we couldn't have anticipated some years before.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people on the stage. Oh, yeah, cool. But now it's sort of like, look what we've been through, and we are back.
It still feels exceptional, it's true.
We are back.
Yeah. See, you have been in the hall yesterday. You have heard the concert with Matthias Pinscher and James Dillon.
What a concert.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in a very amazing, memorable night.
And I was thinking of Esa-Pekka Salonen, who was in L.A., of course, is where you grew up more or less. And he said when he came into Elbphilharmonie for the first time, it was almost like coming home because so much reminded him of the Disney Hall in L.A. And I wonder, what was your impression when you came in here? Was it pretty much the same? Know this, been there, done that? Or?
I feel such an honor to bring this piece here in this festival. It's such a, I'm so humble, and sometimes I think I'm almost like too humble. I have to kind of just be more, I don't know. But I'm so grateful. I had heard, of course, because I was going to come here, but then it couldn't happen. So I'd heard and heard and heard and heard about this incredible structure on the water. And it's a force of nature, this building. And the hall, the acoustics are so clear, which is perfect. It's perfect for this kind of music especially. But I think it's perfect for all music.
I think every hall
should be clear like this. Sometimes I wish, and this is just my tastes, but I wish I heard more clarity sometimes in all music. I love, it's my aesthetic. I like clarity. Of course, I love reverberance and atmosphere and space.
Wagnerian mysteries, like in Bayreuth, you know, where the orchestra is hidden underneath and it's just like spirit above the waters coming out undistinguishable.
I love that too. I think the immediacy of the environment here is a huge gift to the audience members, because you feel really kind of in it. You don't feel far away and sort of like you're reaching for it. It's there. It's right there in front of you. All you have to do is kind of allow yourself to just be in the middle of it, which is very exciting. And for a piece like this, tomorrow it will be quite visceral.
And it'll be packed tomorrow, which is also very nice.
Wow. So, what an honor.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
And you said you also want to play a little just by yourself solo tomorrow in the hall to get a feeling of the space. Do you happen to do this whenever you can?
Wherever I go, it's part of my preparation. I have to feel somehow not taken by surprise in any way. the concerts, the performances, enough with this kind of music have, and, you know, really with any performance, there are so many unknowns that could happen at any time, mm-hmm. any moment, that just to familiarize myself with my environment, I think is just incredibly helpful. It doesn't even have to be, I don't have to play even. I can just stand in my position and just kind of feel the room.
I saw you standing on the stage in the parts where you weren't to play, and you would stand behind Alan, so right at the edge of the stage. And I had this flash of idea that you know the scores so well of the pieces that you play, that I wonder, do you feel a temptation sometimes to take the baton and to conduct an orchestra?
I have thought about it, but as long as I have to be realistic, as long as I have a career as a solo instrumentalist in this field, with especially violin, is very uncompromising. It's so demanding, this instrument, to stay in complete top physical form, just with the mechanics of this instrument. It's so demanding. As long as I'm doing that, it would be difficult for me to make a transition, but we'll see. We'll see.
But have you done like play conducts with smaller ensemble pieces?
I have not done so much of that because most of the repertoire of these pieces is so big.
Okay.
So it never has given, it doesn't give me the opportunity, really. It would be, I mean, I do believe with training, I could do a piece like this, actually. Mm-hmm. But big asterisk, with training. So I would have to get, I know, you know, 1,000 different conducting styles, having stood next to so many conductors, which has been so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I know what I need.
Which is a big 40.
Which is a huge thing to know. And I also can understand with time and with the experience of so many rehearsals and concerts, the demands that the conductor faces, and the time restraints, and the people. There's so many personalities in people, and the people skills that mm-hmm. are needed to be a great conductor, and the many different aspects of what is making a conductor great, all of these things. So it's a big job, and it's a very different kind of job than mine. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about.
To play with it every now and then. And
It's a thought. I mean, it's something that we'll see. But it's kind of a natural transition for certain personalities and for certain people. But, you know, you have to be great. You know, I take it seriously.
Yeah, you have to be as great on the stand as you are at the soloist, of course.
And for some reason, there's a lot of instrumentalists that, I mean, most conductors have been an instrumentalist in some way or another, but violinists that conduct, there's often something that just doesn't, it becomes obvious that they used to play the violin and now they conduct.
I see what you mean, yeah.
And that's not something I think that is desirable.
So drummers are more reliable, probably.
The what?
Drummers are probably more reliable or more, you know, in this.
It's interesting to see, because everyone's story is different. Mm-hmm. Everyone's career is different, and everyone's career path and influences, and you know, we're all unique individuals, that's for sure.
Mm. Would you say you've been a trailblazer when you made that transition to the contemporary and to this repertoire, encouraging people now to go the same direction at least?
I hope, in some ways, definitely, I hope so. Because I think one of the reasons that I was so excited about this path is knowing how important it is for this reason, that let me help in this regard. Let me try the best I can to reach people with this music in important ways that are not intellectual. Mm-hmm. Intellect is a huge thing with contemporary music, obviously, but then there's the whole side of things where you can be so educated and intellectual and blah, blah, blah.
It gets very dry.
And it's, I say blah, 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 because it's not really always hitting the heart. So what I wanted to do is, you know, hit the mind, yes, but also hit the heart.
Or only hit the mind if it also hits the heart.
Yeah, so. It's when you stop kind of trying to plan it all out in such a way that it's sort of all thought out and activated before that special moment where things happen and you just go, oh my God, that was amazing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a totally instinctual, non-planned and non, I'm not really totally being clear about it. It takes the right music to do it too, I think. But just to have some kind of human, direct humanness that reminds us why we are all here in the mm-hmm. concert hall.
And which also brings us together on a very subtle and a good level, I would say.
And why compose? Why do it? There's been incredible people in our past writing music. Why are they doing it? Why are we all in this to begin with? It's for this reason that there's a direct link to humanity and well-being and that music can give us.
Did you ever cross paths with Patricia Kopaczynskaya?
Of course, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Because she is, of course, I mean, if you know her, you know her energy very well.
Yes.
I mean, she still does play occasionally the Beethoven and the Mendelssohn, and of course she's fighting with it in her own sweet way. And
she's a real character, and I admire her courageousness to also think for herself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something that everyone's going to agree with. And
speaking of controversiality, like you said, you know, about John
Adams.
Mean,
very people that take a strong stand. I think that the only important thing in my mind is that they are genuine about it themselves. They must kind of be, in a way, I think, still putting the music before themselves. And that's very important to me, that I'm doing what I think the music is asking, not I'm doing something that will make a big stir. So to know the difference between those two things. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something that communicates when that happens. But, you know, everyone has an opinion.
I was watching your Met performance during COVID.
Yeah.
With this wonderful entrance scene, which I totally love, when you come into the room with the Mark Rothkos and the Jackson Pollocks, and you take your mask off and you throw it, you know, almost like a I don't know, something on the floor, you know.
Yeah.
Like disdain or something. It's a very grandiose gesture, I find. And then you start playing, and I wonder about the Bach piece.
Sure.
The acoustics in this is very special. And
yeah.
Is this what the Bach piece demanded, or was this what you felt it would demand in this circumstances? Because you play it in a very almost theatrical way, and that may have to do with the sound and with the, you know.
I wanted it to be, it was such an interesting, my God, what a crazy time that was. Mm-hmm. Because when I recorded this, it was really still during the very height, 21, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. Something like this. And they had closed the museum for most days, and then there was maybe 2 days a week where a certain amount of people were let in, et cetera, et cetera. And then on one of the closed days, we did the filming and the mm-hmm. recording. But we walked through many rooms in the museum to try to find a place where the Bach was not surrounded by art from the Bach period. Mm-hmm. So we did a juxtaposition of Bach in the modern room and Matthias Pinscher in the Renaissance room with the sculptures. Mm-hmm. So to kind of juxtapose this art together. And I wanted, but the tricky part was that I wanted the Bach room to sound like a church.
Okay, yeah.
So that's why partly we chose this room, but I think the Bach and the Pollock actually were so great together. And mm-hmm. It was a really, I'm very thankful for this experience to be able to do this at that time. And it was to give this Bach piece Life in This Room was really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that you never had really played Bach publicly before.
And that is correct.
COVID just enabled
but there's
you
something
to...
so, actually so contemporary about so much Bach.
Absolutely.
Which is what makes him so timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And such an incredible, important...
Undestroyable in a way.
You can mess
with this music as much as you
and
want.
There is dissonance, incredible dissonance. And to come back to this repertoire after so many years of just not even really, almost sort of avoiding Bach, because I rebel so much against what people say, you have to do this with this style, and this is what's expected of you, and... I sort of ran away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way, actually, I could do this in a way that felt really genuine to me was for me to pretend he wrote it today. Instead of having it become more of a museum-type
mm-hmm.
animal, this was going to be breathing its own fire in a certain way, looking at the score completely in the way that my mind figured it out. It was a lot of struggle for me, though. I mean, between the options, because solo Bach gives you infinite options in terms of choices. And there are many times I tried things a certain way, was convinced, and then later maybe less convinced. Okay, back to the start now. Why am I not convinced?
Mm-hmm.
What do I need to change? So during this whole time leading up to the recording and thinking about and listening to many, many interesting performances on the internet of, really very traditional style, tradition, I mean, in terms of playing older music,
mm-hmm.
and then listening to pre-Bach, which was so interesting to me, and how kind of the viola da gamba and these instruments sounded
Bieber
sometimes like so modern to me
mm-hmm.
and so adventurous. And there wasn't this kind of well-behaved, slightly all of
court
a sudden
music.
We have to button our coats and stand up straight. There was more of like a wild feeling with some of this music before. And so I wanted to bring some of this character to the Bach as well. So it comes even, some of my research was pre, very mm-hmm. much pre-Bach.
Mm-hmm. We have a little concert series going in this season called Wege zu Bach with composers who are his elders and
wonderful.
Bieber and Schütz and Scheidt and all these guys. And
absolutely great. I listened to so much of all of this. And I think there was an urgency in a way because people were dying all the time. At young ages, and you never knew.
And life didn't last long.
No, and there wasn't a safety element mm-hmm. in the performance. So if I hear a performance of Bach that I feel is immediately careful, then I have sort of a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But, I totally have my eyes open that, some Bach experts would probably hold their head in their hands listening to me. But that's okay.
You can live with that.
But the thing is, I wasn't trying to think authentic style. I wasn't trying to think contemporary.
You weren't encumbered by these discussions.
Here I am, a new music player, and listen to the way I play. It wasn't at all this way. It was just what felt human to me somehow.
Some innocence going with it, and some awe, and some...
Absolutely, and some playfulness.
Yeah.
And in some, It's sacred because of the incredible depth of complexity of the emotions that we feel when we hear Bach. But it's not kind of in a glass box sacred. It's a living, breathing, existential fire-breathing dragon, maybe, or something. But it's very, very human. And if we start to make it not human, then I feel we're losing something.
We're missing the point. Last question. I read you are also big time into rock music and advanced styles of rock music. Is that still something that you love?
I listen to my bands. I listen to a little of them a little bit less these days.
I must say
Led Zeppelin is my number one overall. I mean, some Schubert comes in the great Beatles songs, you know, the Yesterday and sure. the Michelle, My sure. Belle and stuff.
But we like rock music for not
but
being too much.
There's some sugar. Kind of crazy grounded rhythmic energy that comes from from Led Zeppelin that I feel all musicians could learn from. And sure. just the raw screams of Robert Plant just go right to the core of some of what we're about, I think.
But you'd rather go for Robert Plant than for, let's say, Kurt Cobain or some grungy reruns?
There's always a time and place for this raw energy, and I respect it a lot. Mm-hmm. And some of the way I play comes from this energy.
When I mean,
there
you
are certain cadenzas,
stage.
New, like, places where I can just be free and sort of let it rip in a certain way. And I think of Jimmy Page with his bow when he was doing these interesting kind of experimental cadenzas with his bow with on the guitar. And there was reverberation and echo and
feedback.
You know, these guys, they had soul, so much of it. But, you know, then you start listening to the jazz singers. Billie Holiday is one of my great heroes. And in fact, the end of A Long Desire, where there's this long line, sort of silken, never-ending melody of kind of improvisational, kind of expressive lilts and inflections, I think completely of Billie Holiday. So much so that I have to keep hold of the reins so that I stay with Alan, because it's
in, you're
it's,
talking of this piece here.
Yeah, at the end of the second, movement, it's so easy for me to just go off into my own. Kind
I
of.
Can totally see this, and I would apply this also to the first movement of the Iron Concerto of John Adams, because this, you know, this unending melody also has.
These are, yeah. But when I start to focus on this very soulful, free, inflective language where you bend. To start to describe these mechanics sounds very cold, but you bend these incredible inflections and pitches in vibrato, and you can use.
It's like the blue notes.
And there's a certain lack of tapering, of kind of polish, of there is kind of a free, fierce quality to it. It's hard to describe it, but you know, listen to Billie Holiday, it's all there.
It's the human voice, which you also have so beautifully in your violin playing.
I thank you. I try to bring some of these qualities.
Thank you so much, Lena.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.